You're listening to the Reading Envy podcast, where I'll have what you're reading. Hi, everyone. This is Jenny, and I'm in the Reading Envy pub with a new guest, Casey Hampton. Welcome, Casey.
Thank you.
Now, technically, I feel like your voice has been on the podcast before.
I was on, I don't know which number it was, but I was on one or two of the episodes where you would ask your listeners to share a couple of titles that they had enjoyed for a year. So
right.
That might be what you're thinking about.
Mm-hmm. And I've been wanting you to be on as a full guest ever since. So
I've been wanting to be on this since episode one. I'm happy to be here. It's really exciting.
So what can you tell the listeners about yourself?
I can tell you an awful lot, and most of it's going to be boring, but I can tell you that I was born in 1974. I graduated high school in 1993. I finished up a Master of Fine Arts in spring of 2017.
So the MFA is in writing?
Correct. It's in creative writing.
Okay. And what kind of things do you like to write? I'm going to ask that first.
I like to write anything that's true. You know, the aim of me, and I think it's probably for most writers, is to write truth, regardless of whether it's fiction or nonfiction. I probably find the most truth in poetry and prose. I'm working a lot on the short form before I tackle novels. And part of that, for me, is that the novel is really enticing because it's this long, looping realm of unexplored territory, and you get to go there. And you get to do whatever you want. And you know it's going to take you a long time to go to all the dark corners. But the other aspect of that is that it's for people like me who are procrastinators, it's too much of an excuse not to get things done. So right now I'm focusing on short stories a lot.
So does that preference in your writing translate to what you like to read? What kind of reader are you?
I think diversity. I try to read a little bit of everything, considering, I guess I didn't really explain this earlier, but when I was 7 years old, let me take you back a little bit. I was born in 74. So in 1981, I was diagnosed with a retinal disease and slowly started to lose my eyesight. For all of my life, I've always only ever listened to literature. It's always been audio format. When I start thinking about literature that I like to listen to, I tend to like any kind of book that will open me up to things that I want to understand better. And that's very similar to what I write, in that I want to understand life, and I want to understand love and lust and loss and longing. What better way is there to do those things by finding different doorways into things that let you kind of look at yourself and the world through a mirror, through text, and whether you're writing it or you're reading it. That's what I'm drawn to. So I guess a long answer here is I like to encounter books that speak to me about truth of the world and people, in the flaws and the attempts that people do and fall down constantly, but still will pull themselves back up, whether that's science fiction or that's epic fantasy or nonfiction. Or, I mean, I'm happy reading Shakespeare, and I'm happy reading Patrick Rothfuss, and I'm happy reading Jeanette Winterson. There's an author that I just recently found and was captivated by. It doesn't have to be any kind of form for me to be appreciative.
So we have each brought books to talk about today, and
yes,
you're the guest, so you get to go first. Where are you going to start?
I am going to start north. I'm going to talk about a book called I Heard the Owl Call My Name by Margaret Craven. It's a book that I actually used when I was an undergraduate for my capstone. The premise of Margaret Craven's book is we learn at the very beginning that a bishop learns that one of the vicars, I guess in their, I want to say a stable, but that's wrong. A stable of vicars. That sounds so awful. he has somebody in his group is being diagnosed, and he only has a certain amount of time to live. And they don't know what to do with him. He's got 3, maybe 2 years of good life left. And so the bishop is thinking, you know, I think I know where to send this guy. And so he picks out a place up in British Columbia, and he sends the vicar, whose name is Mark, and he sends him to an Indian village. to spend time with the Kwakutl. And the Kwakutl are this First Nation people of British Columbia. And so we go along with Mark, and he goes there to learn something. And we don't really know what it is, but we know he's there to do something. And we, at the very end of the book, you get to learn what that was. And really what Margaret Craven shows us is, and it's tragic, it's the effect of white people and Western civilization on First Nation people. It's alcoholism. It's the erosion of culture. It's what happens when, you know, the Canadian government took people from villages and put them into government schools. In this respect, in the story, the children are going to the school on their own free will. They're not being removed. So we get to see Mark, and he's learning about how to handle a boat, because these people live right in the middle of nowhere on a river, on a branching of another river. So he's learning all of these kind of side aspects to his job of being a vicar, of learning. And so he gets to the village and he goes into the church. And one of the first things that we get to see is Jesus painted, like a painting of Jesus, except his eyes and his face is of the Indians, which I think is just wonderful. So the Indians painted Jesus, but put their face on him. And I always kind of look at that and I go, oh, wow, that is kind of what great commentary to say, yeah, you're bringing your religion in here, but we're putting ourselves in that position to look at you with our eyes on the body of your Christ. And maybe that's me going a little too deep, but there's a lot of commentary happening in Craven's book. And I always really want to resist when I encounter people who read this book and say it's really simple, or I read it in junior high. It's a really deep study in what happens when we see what's going to happen. I mean, you know, we all know that you can't stop civilization. You can't stop Western civilization, realistically. You know, in Craven's book, that Western civilization is coming and it's not going to stop. And the real issue is what happens in the meantime. And you go through the narrative, and what we begin to see is, you know, the old ways are old, and there are fewer and fewer people who speak the language, and the children aren't really wanting to come back to the village after they've been to the school, and the elders in the village don't really want them to come back, and they feel guilty for not wanting them to come back, but they welcome them back, but they're happy when they go. What we come to learn is that Mark is really sent here to learn enough about how to live to be ready to die. The subtext of that is the church doesn't have that answer. And that's one of the great little unseen things, is that you have a bishop sending a vicar to the middle of nowhere because the church has no answer for him, which is this great kind of like, let me draw back the curtain and show you that nothing is there. There's not even a guy with levers and things to pull. There's just nothing there. And we're recognizing that. And the only way that we can let you learn what you need to go and learn is with this group of people that is dwindling. And so there's this great kind of commentary between life and death, and are you living? Are you dying? What's the difference? Hmm. And you have to go and figure it out.
And you said you read it first as an undergrad. So what made you think about it again? What made you go back to it?
Well, for a couple of reasons. So the audiobook is read by Frank Muller. His reading of this book and his reading of All Quiet on the Western Front, I think, is probably the closest thing to perfection I've ever heard when it comes to an audiobook narrator. Hmm. So I wanted to hear him read again, but I wanted to come back to this because the writing is so clean. Margaret Craven puts you in a place, and I'm a huge sucker for setting, and I want to be there. She does so, but she does so with a minimalist eye, and she can paint you a quick moving river by just telling you how dark the water is underneath the spruce, or the way the fish will come up and show their belly to the sky. I mean, she does a lot with very simple language. And so I wanted that exposure because it's just something inherently human about being able to go into a narrative and go, wow, I bet this doesn't look like this now. And, right. You know, this was written in, I think, in the 1960s. And Craven went to this place. I mean, this is based on her experience of going here. There's just something inherently sad, in my opinion, about this First Nation people and what does happen. I mean, like there's different little things that stand out. Like when he first gets there, he sees a totem pole, and the very top of the totem pole is a bear, and the bear is wearing a garbage can lid, kind of like a hat, and it's to keep off the rain. But the symbolism of the garbage hat on top of the Indian's totem, regardless of why it's there, is powerful. I mean, the garbage can comes from the white man. And what is it signifying? Is it signifying that their belief is garbage? Hmm. Yeah, it's to keep off the rain, but come on, there's something more there. There's so many different threads you can pull here that's just so rich and vibrant. And to me, it tells you what we need to know, which is, you know, the answers of how to live. It's not just living in one place or another place and with regards to culture. And it's not about walling off a culture from another culture. And it really is learning how to live in both worlds. And that's what Craven is trying to show the reader. You know, we can't wall ourselves off from beliefs or ways of life that we find strange. And this is more prevalent today than any other time that I can remember. You do need to have a bridge to be able to come together. And that's a big part of what's happening here. And the reader is coming to the story, and you have to be able to recognize that your perspective is primarily based in whatever culture you're coming to this story from. And what Craven does is show you that you have to be able to think beyond your little box. I think that's really powerful.
Well, it's funny how books can be related on accident, because I'm going to go ahead and move to my first book. And then if we want to circle back to yours, it might make sense to actually, in a strange way. At the university where I work, I've taken a writing class from a person who writes essay. And one of the essays that she's best known for is partially about her trip to the Arctic Circle and to Alaska. And so she has this pile of books about Alaska that are kind of obscure. I'm going to Alaska this summer, and I asked her if she had any books. She gave me a big bag of them. And so that's why I have this book. I had never come across it at all before. It's called Two in the Far North by Margaret Murray, known as Marty Murray to her friends. You read the book from the read along to The Bright Edge of the World, which was set in Alaska.
I did.
And that was set in like 1884, 1888-ish era. So it starts in 1911 when Margaret is 9 and her family is moving to Alaska. They take this very long trip up in, you know, the boats, because they have to get there before the ice comes down and things like that. And so the beginning part of it feels kind of like Little House on the Prairie, only in Alaska, in the best way. Uh-huh. And then she meets this man named Olaus Murray, who is a biologist. And she gets married to him, and she becomes this kind of frontier bride, only Alaska as the frontier. This is nonfiction. It's composed partially from her diary entries. Sometimes she'll quote from them directly. Other times you can tell they've informed her narrative. So she has different stages in here where they've moved from place to place. Her husband is studying the caribou at the beginning, and so they have to follow the migration, and that takes them very far north. And they're going to backwater places like Fairbanks, where it's a tiny town with lots of mosquitoes. Gross. And they have to travel over the snow. Like, they have to wait for it to snow, and then they travel with dogs over the snow and ice, or they have to go up the river if it's warm. And neither of these things are ideal. And the rivers have a lot of gravel banks and sand banks and things like that. So it's just really hard living, very hard living. She has children. She's often the only female in an entire town, an entire settlement. And a lot of times they're stopping at a cabin where there's one person. They are working with some of the indigenous people who speak a little bit of English. And then it's interesting because there's this shift. They get up to this certain point, and then it's Eskimo people that they're working with. And there's a point where they hit like where it's technically Canada, but they don't really worry too much about it because it's like, if you've gotten all the way up here, go for it kind of thing. Of course, there are some people already moving in for the gold, but they're in it for the biology. The interesting thing about the Murrays is that they had a very big impact on the United States government protecting some of these lands. They were very active in environmental and conservation groups, even just around when Alaska even became a state. They had more of a role in protecting the Yukon area, so very, very far north. They traveled and spoke to Congress. After they did a lot of research in Alaska, they spent most of their lives actually in Wyoming, I think. So they were a little closer to everything. She had an impact on people like Terry Tempest Williams, and she actually wrote the introduction to this 35th edition of this book, 35th anniversary. It came out in 1962 originally. The version I have, though, has pieces after that. There's this entire afterword because her husband died in 1964. And so she writes about that. She writes about moving and not wanting to be in the place that they spent their lives together and the work that she did after that and having grandchildren. You know, so there's extra stuff in this version of the book than there was in the original. I think the draw for me was very much about the adventure and the sheer strength that these two had to have just to even survive. And they didn't just seem to survive. They really, like, there's this whole section where they're dealing with mosquitoes that are so thick that you have to wear netting and everything and like put a spoon under your net to take a bite of something. And, you know, it's awful. It would be terrible. I remember going to the Oregon coast one time when all the mosquitoes had hatched.
I would say hatched. I don't know about burst. That's getting into pretty like horror movie kind of stuff going on there.
Well, that's how it felt because you'd get out of the car and they would just swarm you. And like, there's no way I was going to tolerate that for even 5 minutes, much less spend a few weeks doing research in a place that was like that. And they just kind of seem to take everything in stride. They just have that kind of vibe to them. And the important thing is that they're together and they're doing this work that they think is so important. And I was just so impressed by that whole approach.
So do they go into detail about how do they get their own food or do they pack it or buy it?
Oh, man.
Or hunt or fish or like, tell me how they do that.
It is astounding because if you think about the fact that they're traveling with dogs, they also have to feed the dogs.
Right. Yeah.
But they're traveling on these sleds. And so they pack fish for the dogs, frozen fish. And there's like a layer of that that goes on the sled first. And then there's a layer of food for them. And then there's a layer of all the scientific equipment that he needs because he's collecting specimens here. He's killing animals that are, you know, unique to the area and marking them and tagging them and taking off their hides. And he's processing as he goes. So they're collecting a whole bunch of stuff. They're actually probably coming back with a heavier sled than what they started with. And I mean, it's hard to picture for me because they use the word sled, but it must be giant to be able to fit all this stuff in.
Well, have you seen like the kind of sleds they use when they have dogs and sleds up there?
I've seen like, ones where it's just like for one person, but
this sounds like a much bigger.
Yeah. And then she has a child while she's up there. And so the child hangs out in this box.
Wow.
And so then they also have to worry about that. But yeah, they're killing like rabbits and they have a lot of dried fish and dried meat of other things. And then they kind of refresh it when they visit with other people. But of course, since they're working with native people, they have access to food and food knowledge, hunting knowledge that they might not have otherwise.
Would you say that this is more from her point of view? Like it sounds like
completely.
Maybe.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's going to be things that we don't get to see just naturally.
Yeah. And she does talk a lot about the conflict between what she expects even from herself as a woman versus what she's actually doing. Like she's not setting up a beautiful home. She's not necessarily even cooking for them all that often. You know, sometimes she'll try, but it's just not what their life is. And it was just such an interesting contrast to the Bright Edge of the World where the woman was left behind and she was in this social group of women and she still wore dresses. This lady doesn't even own any. She had a dress for her wedding and that was it. And then she wore pants from that point forward. It's just so amazing to read different people's accounts, because one of the things she talks about in this book at the end is trying to imagine her grandchildren and great-grandchildren coming back and finding these places that no one has yet populated, really.
Oh, wow.
And will that always be true? And in her afterword in this 35th anniversary edition, she says, it's still a place that no one goes. You know,
don't you want to understand? Like, does she like speculate why?
It's too hard of a place to live. And then, of course, the native people aren't always there anymore like they would have been.
Yeah.
But there were certain places that she would talk about, like especially that one really bad mosquito place. The native people knew to leave there at that time. Well, wow. I think that Murray's biggest point in all of this is that there are areas that deserve to be left wild. And that the wilderness itself is something that, and what she said to Congress was, America cannot be so wealthy as to need to destroy the wilderness, but it also can't ever be poor enough that it needs to destroy the wilderness. You know, she's like, surely that's not going to happen. Mm. You know, or shouldn't happen.
Shouldn't, yeah.
It was in 1977, she testified on behalf of the Alaskan Lands Bill. And then in 1975, the National Park Service called her in to speak at the Alaska Humanities Forum. And then she spoke at another forum in 1990 in Anchorage. So she's like become the go-to inspirational speaker on these topics, I think.
I would wonder what she thinks about Alaska and its resources and protection today.
Yeah, she's gone now.
Oh, she passed away.
Yeah, because if you think she was 9 and 1911. So.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So I feel like I've immersed myself in this experience in her life lately, and it was a really good one. And it had been a while since I felt like I had gone somewhere in a book like that. It was a really nice thing to do. So let's move to your second book.
Well, I want to go to my second book, but if it's okay, can I tell a story?
Yeah.
About Margaret Craven before I move on?
Please.
Is that okay? Mm-hmm. So as my undergrad project, I contacted someone who was a Kwakoodle Indian. And so I got a hold of this wood carver who is a First Nation person. And I thought, you know, how cool would it be to have a wood carving? And so I had him carve an owl for me. And in the process of me speaking to him, it was a couple of times, I don't know, maybe between 2 and 5 phone calls that were made between me and him. I got to speak to his mom, right? And his mom turned out to be a girl taken from a village forcefully into a school that was put together by Canadian government. Wow. I got to talk to her about that. And it was like, and so I was knee deep in, well, not knee deep. I was neck deep in research at that point. And I was reading and pulling sources. And here I got to talk to a living person who had that horrible, painful experience. And it brought everything just right to the surface for me anyway, to be able to speak with her. And she was like saying things, and she was asking like, well, how do you know about the, like, there's a reference in Craven's book to the old swimmer. And I was asking about these things. I said, well, what about the old swimmer? And what about, and she was like, well, wait a minute. How do you know about that? And I was like, oh, well, I was reading this thing and I was researching this other, and well, I wouldn't think. And so it was just this kind of moment of being able to connect. But
that's so amazing.
Yeah. And so I've got this really interesting owl carved.
You still have it?
Yeah, I do. And awesome. It's a Kwakoodle carved owl.
Wow.
It's the coolest thing. So yeah, my next book that I'll talk about, I guess we'll talk about Graham Swift. Why not? So I want to talk about Graham Swift, and I want to talk to you about one of his shorter books called Mothering Sunday. And I came to Mothering Sunday by accident. I wanted to go back and reread Waterland. And I was really kind of jonesing for some, I mean, I had read some Iris Murdoch a little while ago and really was like, oh, this is, I really like Murdoch. And I had read her a number of years ago and I wanted to kind of get back into her. And I accidentally read a different Iris Murdoch book than I was going to. I don't know why. And the same thing happened with Graham Swift, wherein I wanted to read Waterland and then I got sidetracked by Mothering Sunday. And Graham Swift is an interesting writer, in my opinion. He really is excellent at writing setting. And the narrative, I think, for some people may be dry. But I think those people, I would encourage them not to give up on Graham Swift. So Mothering Sunday is a pretty short novella. And it's primarily set in 1924. The quintessential outline to this story is that Jane Fairchild is in the narrative. She is kind of the protagonist, and she is essentially remembering a day back in 1924. And it's like towards the end of the 20th century where she's remembering, and she's become an author. And she's kind of thinking back to this one day, and you're given this glimpse. Actually, it's a lot of different glimpses, but and it's kind of through the approach of her giving an interview as an author. But you have great swaths of the narrative where you're just back in 1924. And so Mothering Sunday, the title, comes from the day, I think it's has something to do with like the fourth Sunday of Lent, or I don't know. Yeah, it's something like, but essentially what it means is that in England, they would have a time when the servants would be kind of freed from their bonds, and they would be let loose to do what they want to do, and they wouldn't be beholding to the house or the people of the house. Jane Fairchild is a maid, and it's 1924. And what Swift is doing, he starts you off as a once upon a time. And so we're getting kind of drawn into this fairy tale, and it's post-World War I, and you have all the men who have gone before. You have this change happening in England. And the premise here is that Jane is going to go and be with a man, Paul Sheringham, I think. He is the son of a neighboring estate, and she's just a maid. But they're having an affair, and they're going to be together one last time. And so it's this very drawn kind of moment where they're together, intimate, blatantly together. It's very beautiful. And then he's on his way to go meet up with his fiancée because he's going to be married in 2 weeks. He leaves the house where he's at, and she's there all by herself. And he says, you know, stay, because no one is here, because all the servants have gone. And you have the entire house to yourself. And so there is this scene where she is walking casually around in this old English house, completely naked, and feeling like she owns that place, to where she can just walk around and not be concerned about anything. And she moves into different rooms. And it's this powerful moment in the library where she takes a book off the shelf. I think it might have been Joseph Conrad. And she presses the open book to her chest as if there is a secret just for you. And it's surprising what can be done with something so innocent as a book on naked flesh, but Graham Swift pulls it off. The premise here is coming to a conclusion in that she leaves the house and goes back to where she works, and she's met by her boss. The tragedy is that the man who she was having an affair with, who was going to meet up with his fiance, got into a car accident and died. And what we learned is when they were together earlier, as a reader, we realize, you know, he's really taking his time. He's not hurrying up. He's running late. And he takes all of this care to dress. And he's not really too concerned with the time. And he gets into the car accident at a place that he's very familiar with. And we never really know why he missed the turn. And why was he going so fast? And did he really mean to get into that accident? Was it intentional because it was an arranged marriage? We never really know. Moving forward, Jane Fairchild, you learn that she was an orphan and she was put into servitude. And her first times where she was intimate with this man was kind of as a prostitute, where he would be paying her. So that was kind of weird because she was like 14, you know, underaged. But then it kind of moved into more of a romantic relationship. And so then he's gone and she moves on and she finds her calling to be a writer. She works, she gets married to an Oxford philosopher, but then he gets a brain tumor and dies. In my mind, she kind of becomes the Iris Murdoch of Graham Swift's universe, but she becomes this elderly writer. And to my mind, I guess I would say that this entire book is pivoting on how, as individuals, we think back to moments and we can live an eternity in a day or a moment of a few seconds. And sometimes we linger there and sometimes we find a whole life to live in just a fragment of something in the past. It was such a delight to come to and to learn. This is not your typical Graham Swift experience that I had as a writer, and especially as someone who is, so I'm kind of a hot mess sometimes. I get stuck in my own head and I want to understand things. And it's great when you're creating, but there's a little bit of kind of creative madness happening that really does make you linger in moments where you kind of withdraw from the world. And if you're creating, that's great. And if you're not, you know, it can be problematic. And what Swift is showing me here is we're kind of on this moment where we can turn left or we can turn right, and it can make all the difference in the world. And we can spend the rest of our lives thinking about that moment. I can say for myself, I can think back to maybe 5 things in my life that they're always there. And most of the rest of life has gone away. There are moments that, whether it's the first time you've kissed someone, or the first time you're intimate with someone, or the last time you laughed naked about something with someone, just little things that just linger. And Swift is able to encapsulate an entire life in a very short approach where he focuses on one day. And some of you will have read Ian McEwan's On Chesil Beach. It's really close to that, but McEwan gives you a much more fleshed out life in a day because of a day. Swift is more kind of the bare bones and the jagged parts, and that you don't have the muscle and the tissue connecting as you do with McEwan, but it's very similar. And it was just such a treat to come to for me. So it's a fairy tale, but it's like the worst fairy tale ever, right? The prince dies, and the princess, she never gets out of the coach, and she never gets her prince, because when she does get married, he gets a brain tumor. She lives the majority of her life reflecting, and yeah, she gets to live and love, and she can answer questions and be flip, and she can be a tough cookie. But there's a reason that she is remembering this day, because it was the one day where she wasn't a maid. It's the one day where he told her to come to the front door. So for a brief moment, the once upon a time would be applicable, right? I think that what Swift is trying to show us is that who we are and who we were isn't always as simple as others will see it.
I'm going to talk about my second book, I think. You know, sometimes I listen to the Book Cougars podcast, and they always have a section on their podcast called Biblio Adventures, which I think is brilliant. I'm not going to copy them, but I did go see this author when her book came out. This is Jaws of Life, which is a book of short stories by Laura Lee Morris. She happens to also teach writing at the institution where I work. This is her debut collection. All of the stories are set in a town in West Virginia. I meant to look up to see, well, I guess technically it's the hills of North Central West Virginia. I was going to look up and see if the town name and the company name were real, and I got distracted. But she's from West Virginia, and they're very contemporary. The first story, there's an older woman who has sold some of her land to a fracking company. Since then, she hasn't slept, not because she feels guilty, but because their lights are so bright that she can't possibly sleep in her bedroom. And so she takes it upon herself to take care of the lights one night, and then sleeps great and kind of starts a rebellion in the town. So that was kind of fun. There's a story about a man who marries the woman who crashes into his auto parts store. I guess what I would say is that most of these stories are very character driven, and the characters are very realistic and compelling and flawed and having a lot of challenges in their life. There's a lot of poverty and fewer work options. People are aging more, and people have to take care of the people that are aging. There's several stories that have to do with aging. One in particular, which I think is the title story, this man, he has a wife who has dementia, and he's taking her to the doctor, and he leaves the hospital, and you kind of think he might not be coming back because he's just at this point of kind of hopelessness, you know, and then something happens on the road that kind of makes him come back. And that one was pretty powerful. There's this one where a mom abandons her child after he demolishes the toy aisle at the store.
Oh man.
And she just leaves him there. Like
how old was the boy?
Like, I don't know, 5 or 6, you know, or old enough to take apart the packages and take things out and make an incredibly huge mess, not old enough to take care of himself on his own.
Talk about traumatic though.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a wide range here. It's a slim collection, but I really enjoyed it. I felt a lot of empathy for the characters and felt like I could have read more about all of them and I would have been happy. I honestly really usually struggle with short stories, so I was happy to get into these and to enjoy them so much. I actually had put it off a little bit because I always get a little nervous about reading things when I know the author. What if I don't like it? You know, what's going to happen? These are great. There's another author that I read sometimes that sets things in West Virginia, Scott McClanahan. I would say he's probably a little more snarky, and his stories seem more autobiographical. Hers seem to be about people outside of herself. It's just different approaches. The funny thing is I read half of this one night and finished it in the morning before work. And then that day, there was an episode on the Anthony Bourdain show, and it was about West Virginia. So I sat and watched it and felt like I was watching some of the people who I had just read about.
And it, interesting.
It added this level of reality that was really a nice kind of pairing. Now, that town was farther south, but still in the center of the state, but more of a mining town. But they had the same kind of experience where they used to have this big industry. They were considered like the Hollywood of West Virginia. But now there's fewer people and none of the businesses can make it. And, you know, so it was a really interesting kind of thing that tied together. See, that my first book did that too. It tied to something else. It's just kind of a weird thing that happens to me sometimes. Or maybe I'm just kind of primed to notice it when it does happen because I've just read it and it's been in my brain.
Yeah, you could easily be hypersensitive to the material and to its application around you.
Yeah, and I would say Anthony Bourdain has a way of being really respectful of the places that he goes, I think in ways that people there aren't always expecting, because I read an article from the local newspaper about his show and how he really showed it how it was. And I feel like Laura Morris does the same thing. It's kind of like she's stepping back and telling these stories. I mean, I know they're fiction, but you feel like there's some truth there, like what you were saying earlier.
Yeah, well, some of the most truth, I think, is found in fiction, really.
Yeah.
So did you think that it was like a showcase of the culture, or did you get a sense that there was a clash between contemporary and the way it was back then? Or did you get a sense of kind of like different things coming together?
I think they're all in the challenge together, honestly. I think if there's any conflict, it's with the companies coming in that are taking advantage of them, but not, they're not benefiting from those.
And were the companies primarily like mining?
Fracking.
Like fracking companies. Mm-hmm. So like, was there any kind of undertones of like, I mean, that's powerful symbolism, right? I mean, you're extracting things out of the land that holds their ancestors for profit that they don't even get to have a part of. Did you get a sense that if you wanted to go deeper that you could extrapolate, or did you get a sense that this was more just narrative and this is what happens in this area at this given time?
I feel like they're more like narratives, but I'll have to ask her.
I was just curious. It sounds really good. I mean, like, you've already made me want to go and read it. Short stories are just, they can be so powerful, though. I mean,
yeah.
I think it was Stephen King, right, who said a good short story is a kiss in the dark. But I think they can be so much more than that when they're well done.
Right.
What was your favorite story out of the group? I mean,
I like the granny shooting out the light bulbs.
Was that because that's what you envision yourself when you're of a senior age?
Well, I wouldn't sell my land to frackers. Sorry. No amount of money would do that.
You would be a steadfast. You would say no to that $10 billion.
Okay, so the paragraph that talks about that says, when you're looking at a check full of zeros for just a few acres of land, you think about a new roof, replacing the furnace that hasn't kept the house properly warm in at least 10 years. You think about how you won't have to pinch pennies until the beginning of the next month. You don't think about the fact that fracking is a 24-hour business or that they'll point their lights straight at your bedroom window and claim it's the only angle that works.
I think that sounds like there's a lot happening there. I don't know what I would do. I mean, when you live in poverty, you have if you are given a way out of it, I think it becomes a really difficult dilemma. What do you do?
Right. And I think that shows up through a lot of the stories. The funny thing is, there's never a thought that they would leave, even if they have the money, you know?
Because like they wouldn't just go and start somewhere else.
Right. Because that's just not what you do. You're part of this community. And I think you see that even as they get older, they're like having whiskey on the porch with the neighbor. And there's just a lot more of a community feeling than I think most of us experience anymore. And that really resonated with the Anthony Bourdain thing too. Like, no, this is our home. Like, it doesn't matter how bad it gets. It's not like we're going to leave.
Because we're in it together. We kind of have this shared experience or the right. shared commissary of the pain and the struggle.
Yeah.
And having an outsider come in, I think especially in that kind of area where you do have a lot of historical family roots going back and communities really tight. When you have big money coming in and doing awful things to the ground and to the water that you drink, it's going to rive a community. It's either going to cleave them together or cleave them apart.
Right.
It's powerful.
And it sent me off on an internet rabbit hole too. I was looking at these charts and graphs about how there's all this money being made, but the people in the community aren't the ones doing the work. Like they're not getting hired. Because there was this yeah. kind of story that people who worked in mines would be able to work for the fracking companies. And in fact, fracking companies bring in their own employees.
Yeah.
No. And so there's all these people who are unemployed sitting around these people making money. It's a weird combination for sure.
I think it sounds awful, right? Because yeah. when they get what they want, they're going to be gone. And guess who's going to be stuck there with water that you can't drink? It's going right. to be the locals.
Well, let's move to your third book.
Yeah. So let's talk about Jeanette Winterson. I completely found her by accident, and it was just like somebody walked up behind me and cracked me in the head with a cinder block. I wasn't ready for it, and it dropped me to my knees. It was moving. And so the book that I want to talk about is Written on the Body, and it's mostly poetry, and there's an awful lot happening in this. I mean, I say poetry. It is poetry. I mean, I think the whole thing is poetry. I think it's one long prose poem. At the top level, it's really about the protagonist. You never really get to know the protagonist's name or her gender, although clearly I think it's a her. I think that to me is a distraction. I think that's the only flaw that I will point at in this book, is I think it's a wonderful idea that you go through this story and you never know the protagonist's name or their gender. And I just kept thinking that is an unnecessary distraction. But the protagonist, the I of the story, you're shown that this person is having a lot of relationships and they're failing. And then she comes to Louise, who is married. They fall in love. Louise gets diagnosed with leukemia. And then as some very bothersome personal issues that I have, the protagonist decides, I'm going to be the greater altruist here. And I'm just going to leave Louise, because that way Louise can get help medically from her husband, and the protagonist goes away because they're going to do the greater good thing. It's a love story, and it's the whole question of what love is. But more than that, Written on the Body, what is this implying? It's getting into the aspect of we're splitting ourselves into two parts, and our body is the physical representation and it's the physical entity. So we have fingers and toes and knees and ankles, and then we have the non-corporeal aspect of us. It's a meditation on what is love. Where is it? Is love in your consciousness or is love in your marrow? Is it in your bones? Where is it? Because love isn't something that you can think. It's something that you can be moved by. It's this whole, I can't even begin. I mean, Jenny, you've read this and you know what I'm talking about when I say it's multi-layered and it's beautifully complex, and it's heartbreaking. I mean, it destroyed me. I'm trying not to give too much away, which I probably did, but you go through the experience of falling in love, and you go through the experience of not having that person around you and thinking you're doing the right thing. And of course you never do the right thing. And why? It's because you're using your head to compensate for what you can't compensate for, which is love, right? You never can dictate love with your brain. It just never, ever works. And the character here tries to do that and fails beautifully. And the misery at the end, it's just, I think, because that last moment where you're walking back home after she tried to go find Louise, she's amongst the animals. Why is she there? Well, I think she's there because Winterson is showing us that maybe we only really know ourselves when we are most away from our contemporary citified thinking. And the character is moving through a bucolic landscape under moonlight. And what is she trudging through? She's trudging through ice and muck and cow manure. All the cows are looking at her and she's thinking about animals, and she's coming back to the realization that maybe you really can't use your head to move love. Love moves you. In the first part, you kind of go through this more of traditional narrative. You get to a second part where it's kind of the body, the earlobe or the eye or the tongue. It's wonderful. And she's doing this because she's trying to understand leukemia and what that is. And I don't know. I can't even really do a good job of telling you what it's like, except that it was an amazing experience to me. I haven't hit a writer like Winterson in a long time. The emotional resonance for me, I think I could point to maybe Ian McEwan's On Chesil Beach. That had a pretty classic emotional resonance. I would also compare Winterson to an author I'm currently reading from Brazil, Clarice Lispector, where she turns you inside out and basically scrapes all of the secret parts until you're clean, and it hurts, and it's this amazing insight. But that was my experience. I don't know what yours was like when you read.
It's so moving. Yeah. I mean, she's one of my favorite authors. And it's hard to express it. It's like the story that's happening in the book isn't really the point. It's the writing for me. I was trying to find a good, like, little tiny quote to read or something, just like as a little taste. Like, when I say I will be true to you, I'm drawing a quiet space beyond the reach of other desires. Things like that. You're like, ugh.
Yeah. And there's a point where I don't have a good example, but there was one quote where she talks about logic. The logic center of her mind is opening on blank corridors and vacant stairways. And it's showing you that.
Wow.
When you think, you try to think your way through something that is emotional, you're only ever going to get lost in the warren of whatever you thought was there but isn't. And it's this beautiful metaphor, but it's all poetry. I mean,
oh yeah.
If you ever want to just dive naked into pure words, this is the book to do it, I think. Mm-hmm. And talk about sexuality in the most amazing ways. I mean, whether you're talking about rock salt pools or, you know, olives, I'll never think about an olive the same way, or tree roots. I mean, at the very beginning, I mean, that's the other great part of this whole book, is that the very question at the very beginning of this book is posed in such a magnificent way. It's, why is the measure of love loss? So we aren't even asking you if the measure of love is lost. We're asking you, why is it this way? And why are we wanting to know that at the very beginning of all of what we encounter between the body as body and the body as the embodiment of who we are? It's because we can't arrive at the answer without letting go of our logical part of our brain, right? I mean, this is something we feel through. It's a hand in the dark is basically what this is. And it's beautiful, mm-hmm. I think.
Well, and I wonder about something you said at the beginning about how you found the genderlessness distracting, but like it came out in 1992, right? So
yeah.
I think back then playing with gender was revolutionary.
I totally agree, except I just found it distracting because you, whether it's her delivering a punch to Elgin, the husband, whether it's her talking about how certain men do something, whether it's her talking about, I say her here, and I'm referencing the protagonist. It's so feminine in its interpretation as a reader. I'm saying there's no way this can be a man. Hmm. And it works fine for it to be a woman. So you're not going, I mean, like, if I were to put on my workshop hat here and take us into an MFA course, I'd say, this is brilliant. This is so amazing that I'd use really foul language to tell you how beautiful and gorgeous it is. And let's get rid of it, because it's only going to ever distract your reader. And you don't want to do that in something so much that has so much perfection. But we can't do that. You know, it's published and it's out. And I know that it's a product of its time, but
you're reading it now.
But even if I would have read it in 92, I'd say, what is it really doing? It's not helping. I don't know I'll stop blithering and ask you, for you, what did it add? What did it allow you to do?
I think it creates a bridge to the reader, because maybe a reader wouldn't be ready to imagine the possibility of a woman being that person. But then by having to imagine it, but not being sure either way, I don't know, maybe it lets it in.
Do you mean like you mean like commentary on homosexuality, or commentary on just the bodily lust, or?
Yeah, I think homosexuality for sure. But then just like how the relationship itself has so many different facets. I mean, of course it's very physical, but it's so much deeper than that. Like the connection is, you know, she wants to be inside of her, like blocking these things from happening. Like it's very, I don't know if you use the word visceral, but that's the word that comes to mind. If there's more than one possibility, then other things become possible too.
You mean in what application?
I mean, you could almost go to a point of quantum theory, which I don't think she's doing. No. But
I think that you could make a strong argument. I mean, like, Jenny, if you wrote an academic paper and turned that into me, I'd say, tell me more, because you're getting right into that issue of randomness, and you can't have a predictable path. I mean, that you could easily make a strong case for quantum mechanics and quantum theory in relation to the body as body and body as the embodiment of the self.
Once you've had an impact on this person and you walk away, I'm not sure your impact stops.
No, it never. Of course not. No.
Which is kind of connected to your previous book.
Well, they're all connected, right? Life, death, love, lust, and longing. We are a product of everything else, which can be great and it can be horrific. But I mean, I guess I think that you've got a really strong case when you say it's 1992.
Yeah.
Sure. I think that's valid. I still will get up and rail that I think I'll do this. For me, the distraction, the volume of energy that it took for me to juggle him, her, for the protagonist, I wanted to apply to the love. I wanted to apply to the loss. I wanted to apply to something else that meant more. If this was equivalent to me putting pennies in a bank, I wanted those pennies to go other places. I didn't want them to be where I got the sense that this is almost, but not quite, too cute by half, you know, and maybe it's just 1992, and maybe that's part of it.
Yeah. And maybe to her, having that kind of approach helped it kind of move over from just being an erotica novel. There's a danger of it being reduced to the margin of that. And I think because of her previous works, maybe she was concerned about that. Oh, like that's just the lesbian author, or you know what I mean? There's all these boxes you can get put in. And if you end up in that box for so long.
Oh, those damn boxes. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Then you're not being taken seriously and you're not getting the audience you deserve. And she deserves the broadest audience in my mind.
If I could, I'd still pour a bucket of water over it.
Yeah, you still don't like it. That's right. Have you ever read The Argonauts by Maggie Nelson?
No, I have not.
Okay, so it's nonfiction. It's about her and her partner, and she writes a lot about how bodies change. Her partner is genderqueer, so does not really necessarily identify with one gender or the other. And I wonder sometimes, too, if this book just predates that concept being common enough for people to even understand it or know what it is. Like, there's definitely a tipping point for that topic, right? So I wonder too, if maybe that's really what she wanted to be able to play with rather than I'm keeping it secret from you.
Yeah. See, that was the total thing. It was like, I'm keeping it secret, wink, wink. And right. I know, you know, that I know that, you know,
right? But what if it wasn't that? What if it was this other thing?
I think author intent is meaningless, but you could totally be right. You probably are right. I mean, you,
well, I don't know. I think it's interesting to think about.
For me, the bridging, it arrives in the universality of love. I mean, love is love, right? So it's going to push you and it's going to pull you. And if you're thinking about the long-term consequence or the mortgage, and that's not love. And it's an essential part of relationships. But I get the sense that this isn't about the mortgage. This isn't about how many grams are in a kilogram. This is about how do I try even to begin to quantify something amorphous. You just can't.
And that's the thing that she does so brilliantly.
Yeah. For me, what happened after I read this book is I wanted to read more. Mm-hmm. I mean, I needed more. She became a drug. And it was, I mean, really, I was jonesing for Winterson in a bad, good way. I have to kind of push away from that because it's kind of like you're getting sucked into the black hole where time stops and you're there and there's just this beautiful volume of language being given to you. And it's like you're getting mainlined with Winterson and everything else falls away. Yeah. And as wonderful as that is, it can be very damaging to a reader, I think. But I want more.
But isn't that amazing that she could have that power?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Okay, I've already talked about other podcasts today, but I also listened to The Readers. Hi, The Readers. And they're doing summer reading this year, and they posted the long list, their quote-unquote long list of books they were choosing from. Now, we're recording on May 2nd, so I actually don't know which book they've picked. I just decided to read them all. I mean, I'd read half of them already, so I can't go to their readers retreat they're having in September in San Francisco. I wish I could. So this is a book that somehow had escaped my noticing it. It came out, I think, in March of this year. It's called Girls Burn Brighter by Shobha Rao. And it is a debut novel. And it's about a friendship. These two girls who live in India, in Indrawala, which is an area that is, well, at least the group of people that they belong to makes cloth, like for saris, and they're deeply poor. I mean, West Virginia, nothing. Like, they don't have money for food, much less anything else. And it doesn't even seem like they go to school or anything. And these two girls become friends. And so it's about the connection that they have and how that follows them through their lives, and when bad things happen, they still have this kind of connection and one will try to find the other. I think what I really liked about it is by the end, I cared so much about these characters and I was invested in them being okay, you know? Mm-hmm. And I don't know that that happens very often. Most of the time I'm not thinking of the characters as that real. I mean, I know they're not real, but I was really invested in them. And I think I sat and read this in an afternoon, and it's over 300 pages, but I was going to read just a little tiny bit. This is from the very beginning, like page 14 or so. The two women are called Purnima and Savitha. So this is Savitha. She stood in the middle of their meager hut and tallied all the ways in which she could make money. She could collect garbage, which clearly wasn't bringing in enough. She could cook and clean as her mother did, though there were hardly any families rich enough in Indrawali to keep even her mother employed. She could work the charka and the loom. She did belong to the caste of weavers, after all. But money from making cotton saris was dwindling each year, and given how little each sari brought in, if a family owned a charka or a loom, they kept the work within the family to keep the money there as well. Savitha looked at her charka, broken, draped with cobwebs, slumped in the corner of their hut like a heap of firewood waiting for a match. For 5 years now, they hadn't had the money to get it fixed. If only it were fixed, she thought, I could make us some more money. She was, of course, aware of the absurdity of the thought. She needed money to make money. But thread, to hold it again between her fingers. She still remembered clutching a bowl of cotton in her tiny hands when she'd been a little girl and being amazed that such a bit of silly fluff, filled with dark and stubborn seeds, could become something as lovely and smooth and flat and soft as a sari. And so from there, she walks to the Weaver Collective and ends up working for this other girl's father. And so that's how they meet. So earlier this year, I read this book called The Lives of Others by Neil Mukherjee, which is like a book of connected short stories. So in that book, there was one story about this man returning to the slum. It was like he could have walked into that area and met these girls. The two books felt connected to me. I mean, I know they're just vividly writing about India, but I felt like I was revisiting something I'd already touched on a little bit, which was really interesting. But this is about how they're surviving in that space. Yeah, I just couldn't stop reading it. I don't want to spoil too much of the journey, but some of the book does take place in Chicago. So there's definitely a human trafficking element to the story.
What resonated most with you?
The friendship felt very genuine. A lot of times when you have stories from these more traditional cultures, it's the family that matters. But I think in this case, the families had not been the strong part. It's the friendship that's the strong part. And I don't know that for some reason that did stand out. And just like what you cling to as things change, because obviously their livelihood, their whole caste is kind of disappearing because of industrialization and cloth making in particular. But they have this connection that it follows over an ocean even. There's a lot of strength to it. This seems like one of those books that you could have a great book club discussion, and I think it would be accessible to more people. But I don't mean accessible as an insult. And I think sometimes that word is used to say, you know, something's just like popular or everyone can read it, it's easy. But I think the subject matter isn't easy. And the way it's put together, I think, is masterful. Kind of in the way where like people who are good at ice skating, they jump up in the air and twirl around four times. You're like, oh man, looks easy.
Well, you don't do that when you ice skate. I do that all the time. I mean, yeah. I thought everybody could.
I can't stand up holding onto the edge, so.
I can fall down. That's what I'm good at.
No, but I think that's a deceptively easier read in that sense. But I feel like it's a reflection of a very skilled writer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's getting to be almost 10 o'clock for me. Are there any books that you're excited to read next or that you're reading?
I've got a lot of books that I'm excited to read about. And I was told in pre-production that I couldn't tell you all of them. I'm really excited to continue reading Clarice Lispector. She's a Brazilian writer, and she is amazing and frightening, and I both want to read her, and I also want to put the book in a freezer. It's terrifying in a really, really good way. So I'm excited to pick her up, and I really have a lot of other things that I want to read, and I can't just pick one. So there's a lot of books out there. I know that I'm kind of anxious to go and read a little bit of Shakespeare, but there's some Ballard. There's just so many. So I'm curious to know, what about you? What do you have on the horizon?
Well, I actually started two books this morning that I'm pretty excited about. I've been waiting to read Circe by Madeline Miller because I'm reading it along with a group. I had read her previous novel and liked it, The Song of Achilles. So this is also kind of a myth retelling, which I usually don't necessarily like. So we'll see how it goes. And then I started listening to the third book of the Themis Files by Sylvain Neuvel, called Only Human. And I have been making up reasons all day long to listen and do, like, what can I do that I can do while I'm listening? So it's good. I'm really enjoying it. But I'll never be able to talk about it on the podcast, because even to talk about where the book starts would be a spoiler for the second book. So I'm just saying those books are good. They're better in audio because they have multiple narrators, because they're kind of told in pieces. It's like an artifact novel, science fiction. Everyone should listen to this. Thank you so much for talking to me about
books
today in the pub. They're kind of glaring at us across the bar, so I think it must be last call or something.
Man, I am so going to pour some scotch whiskey and enjoy the rest of my time here. You guys can just go away, and I will continue to talk forever. Just turn off the lights, right?
Thanks for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can follow me on Twitter at Reading Envy, or find a complete listing of our podcast episodes, as well as all of the books discussed on today's episode, at readingenvy.com.
Mukherjee, what is that?